Welcome to CineLit. Today we are packing our imaginary bags and going on a cinematic holiday abroad. A lot of our listeners will be mourning the lack of sunny climes, sandy beaches and cheap sangria. But we hope to take everyone on a summer holiday and maybe show you that you're probably better off staying at home. My name is Adam Marsh and I am joined by CineLit's resident expert Daryl Buxton. Hello, Daryl.
Hello, Adam. Hello, everyone.
And continuing the metaphors, our tour guide for our trips out today is the host of Derby Quad's Midweek Treat every Wednesday, film lecturer David Lester. Hello, David.
Hello, Adam. Pleased to be here.
Great stuff. Now, eager-eared listeners may remember David from our third ever podcast way back in February 2020, or pre-COVID as we're calling it now, when we discussed the streetcar named Desire. We've been wanting to get David back on CineLit ever since, but as the pandemic intervened, we've only managed to get it now, but here we are, and we are delighted to manage to reconvene. And today's topic is David's choice. Summer holidays, David.
Yeah. Well, it seemed appropriate, as many people would not be able to go on holiday, to at least go into a cinema or a pretend cinema and pretend you are on holiday.
Yes.
And not deliberately, but interestingly, the films I've chosen have all really been made... They're British films, essentially. Mm-hmm. Some set in this country, some not. And, I'd like to start with my first choice. It's a really interesting curio called Holiday Camp. Now, this was the first in a mini-series of films starring the Huggett family. Made in 1948, they made three Huggett family films, Here Come the Huggetts and The Huggetts Abroad. And this was the first one, didn't mention Huggetts in the title. It starred a pre-fame Jack Warner, who would go on to become Dixon of Dock Green in the long-running TV series. Not so well-known there, but an established character in British culture. And also a very young pre-fame Diana Dawes, which is of interest. The Holiday Camp, well, it's all there in the title, really. A family going on holiday alongside other working class families, all getting the same couple of weeks off, head for a holiday camp. And what shocked me now, looking at this film from, obviously, the distance of years, is how regimented these holidays were. There is not a spare moment, it seems, within the film for people to just relax and do whatever they want. All the activities are organised for them. So you're getting snake lines of people in their thousands weaving in and out of this holiday camp, all singing Knees Up Mother Brown or whatever it might be.
Mm. I thought it was really interesting seeing them all exercising on the grass there. And it's like it's all regimented, lined up. And just thinking, this is 1947, probably 8 years earlier, that very venue would have been an internment camp for German prisoners of war, and they'd have been doing the very same thing, you know, marching them out to give them exercise in between shouting at them, you know. Yeah.
There is an element of sort of organised fun, and I think that's very much part of the British psyche, you know. It translates to things like office work to this day, I think, where, you know, you have your sort of office Christmas party, or you all go out to celebrate someone's birthday, and you're sort of ordered to do it by your manager, you know. And the holiday camp experience is very much like that, and I think it's very well captured in this film. It's almost like 1984 at times. You've actually got disembodied voices making announcements over the camp tannoy, over the PA, and sort of literally barking out orders to the holiday makers, telling them when they can eat, when they can sleep, when they can go to the camp bar and things like that. And as you say, when they've got to do their exercises and so on. And
I really thought he was going to say when they can go to the toilet.
You wouldn't be surprised if that happened, you know. You could almost show Holiday Camp on a double bill with a film version of something like 1984 or some sort of dystopian type thing. And it would make it quite an interesting sort of parallel, I think. One thing this film does very, very well is it really shows the sort of post-war state of Britain, and the post-war state of Britain as it applies to the working family and the working man, the very people who would have been away fighting in the early 40s. What happens next? What happens after the conflict has finished? There is this sort of vague sense of freedom and a chance of getting away and doing what you like. But then, that contrasts with this odd sort of regimentation.
And of course, that would, I mean, you're looking forward from this film, recognising that in the following decade of the 1950s, places like Butlins were hugely popular.
Yes.
Pontins, you know, all these real life holiday camps really took over. The idea of foreign travel was completely out for most people. And I think this film, and I would argue in many ways that all British films are essentially about class. And quite clearly in Holiday Camp, it's working class people that are there.
Yeah.
You would hardly see a middle class family or individual there. It's not kind of a culture to make films about middle classes on holiday, not as a kind of phenomenon, as individual dramas, yes, but not as anything that reflected on that class.
Mm. Yeah, the extra thing you've got there, which we've already touched on, is the fact that this is a post-war film, and that plays into there's like a strata within that class system that isn't there at any other time in British history, or very few other times in British history, where you've got your sort of working middle and upper class, but you've also got the sort of returning servicemen as well.
Mm.
And they seem to be allocated a certain level of respect and a certain level of treatment by all of the other people in the holiday camp, you know, and they're sort of allowed to sort of talk among themselves about their wartime experiences and so on. What's interesting in terms of class is that there's this very, very strange subplot which is beautifully introduced on a newspaper headline and then sort of laced through the second half of the film about a serial killer.
The Mannequin Murderer.
The Mannequin Murderer,
right,
yes, yeah. And this is where you've got your a classic situation that often occurs in British drama, where you've got a character who's acting like a sort of upper middle class figure who seems to be better than everyone else, and you've got this murder plot going on, and it turns out to be the same person, you know, they're sort of not, they're masquerading, they're not quite what they appear to be.
Yes, it's quite surprising to have that element in what is essentially a fun film.
Yes.
I mean, you know, you're immediately thinking of something like Brighton Rock there.
Indeed,
you know, a seaside setting.
Yeah, it's also got the other subplot. Isn't entirely played for laughs, and could be. It's the gambling scam that goes on, involving the Huggett's son. And Jack Warner comes in, pre-Sergeant Bilko, sort of comes in and does a sort of Phil Silvers on the shady gangsters and ripping everybody off of their holiday money.
Yeah, that's a nice touch, that, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's interesting that isn't necessarily played for laughs. It's played in a very gritty sort of Brighton Rock.
Yeah, you're set up for Jack Warner's character to be scammed as well.
Yes,
and of course he turns the tables completely.
Yeah, and I think the fact that Warner would be known to the audience at that time as a sort of comic figure, unlike what he sort of became later through Dixon. At this time, he was sort of known as a comic player, but this allows him to sort of spread his wings a little bit and he's got the comedy scenes and the one-liners and the stuff where he's sort of ordering the family about and so on.
Mm.
But suddenly here's a scene where he can get tough and he can put one over on the bad guys, and he can then sort of deliver morals to his family as well. And it's interesting. It could have gone down that Sergeant Bilko type route of playing it all a bit more for laughs, but it's a subplot that's quite hard hitting in the middle.
Yes,
there's
a lot of ingredients there, aren't there? And it's looking, of course, across the age groups as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's got a weird sort of, like, I mean, it's got a documentary feel to it in some ways. Like, in a sort of like, this is what the working classes do when they go on holiday. And you follow, like, quite a lot of, like, individual characters. It's not like, it's not about the Huggetts, essentially. It's a cross-section of a bunch. It's an ensemble movie in many ways. And as I was thinking that, I realised the director had done documentaries prior, and obviously brings that to the experience here. And I'm assuming that, I mean, I haven't seen the other Huggett movies, but I'm assuming that kind of style went out of the window and it became much more of like, let's see the Huggetts somewhere else, let's see the Huggetts go abroad, Huggetts go to prison or whatever, and it's much more family focused.
Oh, it's comedy. Yes, yeah. That's right. But yes,
yeah,
there were other families in British entertainment as well, from radio and early TV, like the Lyons being a famous one, who this became a sort of regular thing in British cinema of late 40s, early 50s, yeah. was that you'd have films about these family groups. But yeah, the first one, as you say, Adam, does it sort of uses them as a fulcrum, as a sort of focus, and then has the characters from the family sort of going off and meeting other people. And so we get this sort of tapestry of stories, and it's quite an interesting way to sort of tell that.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously popular as well. Otherwise, they wouldn't have made the subsequent two films.
Yeah, no, hugely popular, yeah. wasn't it? Yeah.
And, I mean, it's if we look at in a historical setting, this was an uncomfortable time for the country. You know, we were bankrupted by the war. You had this cold spell. You had, beginning of the welfare state, which is wonderful, but how that survived against the economic backdrop at the time. But there's no hint at the moment of dissatisfaction amongst the population with what they're having to endure.
Well, certainly in this film there's not.
No, and also, I mean, you can understand what a pleasure it would have been to take a rest from the economic troubles you might have had and all pack away on holiday. You can't help but be happy because everyone around you is happy.
Yeah, yeah, and it's also like, I don't really know much, but I'm assuming during the war people weren't going on holiday. You know what I mean? So no. Some of them wouldn't have had holidays in years.
They
wouldn't have
had a holiday in France or Italy.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I just got a quick trip to Germany. I mean,
that's, yes, that's right, yes.
Yeah. I think the film's got a legacy as well within British cinema. If you look at what's happened in British movies since, this is a film directed by Ken Annakin. It's produced by Sydney and Muriel Box. It's written by Peter Rogers, who went on to produce the Carry On films. Right. And at heart, it's a lowbrow, working-class British comedy, and that's been a staple of British cinema ever since. And Peter Rogers, right at the heart of that, I guess, with the Carry-Ons, of which there were at least three Carry-On films out of their 30 or so that you could call holiday movies, Carry-On Cruising, Carry-On Abroad, Carry-On Camping, I guess. Yeah. Maybe one or two of the others fit the bill as well. And you've then got films beyond that, like Confessions from a Holiday Camp, for instance, with Robin Asquith and the team. TV sitcoms became notorious for, how do we expand the TV sitcom onto the big screen? What you do is you take your characters on holiday, and that happened in Holiday on the Buses. It happened in The Likely Lads, where they go on sort of camping and caravanning holiday. It happened in Are You Being Served, where they all went, all of the department store staff went to a Spanish hotel. And that continued into the 21st century, unbelievably. You know, it's not an old-fashioned, outdated 70s thing, because since then we've had the Harry Enfield sketch show turning into the movie Kevin and Perry Go Large, which is set on Ibiza, and the first In-Betweeners movie, which was set on a Greek island. So there's still that sort of trope of British sitcoms taking their characters away on holiday, and it often happens in sort of special sort of Christmas editions.
Yeah, I was about to say that
feature length editions on TV as well.
The gap between those ones. Like in the 80s and 90s, those Christmas specials, those Miami Twice and Hyacinth Bouquet going on the boat on the Queen Mary.
And in the Huggies film, you can see the roots of all this. You know, it's a fascinating film, I think, for British film historians, because you can see how, in fact, directly through Peter Rogers, you can see how the Carry On films sort of span off from movies like this. And Rogers is in there; he's scripting this, and there are sort of almost proto Carry On type gags in there at times. Yeah. You know, and the way the characters sort of respond to each other. And the way Jack Warner's almost like the Sid James of this movie, and you can see those character types evolving.
Yeah, I mean, do we see a similar trend in films in other countries? Do you think?
I think in Italy, the sort of like comedies of going on abroad, the Italian comedy is very much so. Yeah, comedy all Italia.
The thing is, and I think this applies to British films as well. This type of humour doesn't travel. It's very parochial. It's very sort of insular, and this is why we know there are films like this in Italy, but who's seen them outside of They don't even appeal to everyone in their home country. You know, they tend to appeal to lowbrow audiences. So even if you went to Italy and started talking to friends over there or people involved in film over there about this level of Italian comedy, they probably just sniff and say, oh, no, we don't like those. Yeah. In the way that you might get British critics and British film people saying that about Carry On Abroad or about Confessions from a Holiday Camp.
Yeah.
Moving on to David's next choice, there's something a bit more about this one. It's obviously directed by a very small-time director who no one's ever heard of, David Lean, you know. So we're looking at David Summertime. Who? Yeah, yes. David who?
Yeah.
Summertime, 1955.
Yeah, thinking about David Lean and his films, you could argue that practically all his films are about escape. And this is a case in point, Summertime. We can, if we, having seen this film about a middle-aged single woman going on holiday in Venice and getting embroiled in a romance. Obviously, you're thinking ahead to things like Shirley Valentine as well. Mm-hmm.
Again, the woman you've mentioned there, David, played by another little known, sort of undiscovered talent, a lady called Catherine Hepburn.
Yes, well, I wonder what ever happened to her career after.
Yeah, she only had 12 Oscar nominations for Best Actress, yeah. Including this film. So, she was immensely talented. When we talked about Catherine Hepburn on the podcast we did earlier on the year, when we talked about RKO. But mainly about her early years when we're talking bringing up baby and things like that. At this point in her career, she has got this character down pat, the sort of like a middle-aged, still has life in her, but, she's either a widower or she's a spinster. Yeah.
She's playing Catherine Hepburn.
Yeah. Yes, she's playing a middle-aged Catherine Hepburn.
Gloriously so, I think, as well. She pulls out all the usual stops. She just does everything that you want from her, but... That's what audiences would have expected that at the time. If you're putting your ticket money down to see a Catherine Hepburn movie, if you pay to see a Fred Astaire movie, you want Fred to dance,
Yes.
If you go and see a Catherine Hepburn movie, you want this sort of elegant, sophisticated, waspish, biting, cutting sort of character who's got a sense of style, very much her own woman, and able to sort of hold her own in an argument or a debate or a conflict, and to do so in a sort of humorous and cutting way. And we get that in spades here, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to compare her and her career at this stage with someone of a similar age, Ingrid Bergman, who cut her ties with Hollywood famously and went off with Rossellini to make these films like Stromboli and Journey to Italy, which again are set in, kind of exotic places, but you wouldn't call them necessarily holiday films.
I think they're not very happy.
They're certainly not.
Journey to Italy.
I mean, Journey, yes, you're looking at a divorce there.
Exactly.
With Stromboli, you're looking at this young woman who's taken into, the island of Stromboli and realises it's a prison sentence on this black volcanic island from which there is no escape.
Mm. In saying that, though, Journey to Italy, about a holiday that almost results in divorce, is probably very familiar to many married couples out there.
Well, yes. And the highlight is going to Pompeii and seeing loads of dead bodies, which are obviously of the victims of the volcanic eruption.
We're talking as though Summertime is a barrel of laughs,
moments of humour. Inevitably someone's going to fall in the canal, and it happens to be Catherine Hepburn.
Which apparently she did her own stunt on that.
Yeah.
Was like very, very happy to do her own stunts. And she's like, yes, fantastic. She did it and then got a massively bad infection in her eye. It affected her for the rest of her life. So it's like, maybe you should have done your own stunts at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. How much of this film do you think is David Lean attempting to recapture the glories of A Brief Encounter? Because it's got that element.
Yes, it certainly is. I was aware of that. He made a kind of interesting film, which kind of goes under the radar a bit, sort of in between those. And that's The Passionate Friends, which starts off in Switzerland, where this central character goes on holiday and she's reminded of a romance that she had some 10 years before. She's married now, but her flame turns up there and, of course, reignites this affair.
So it's an idea that sort of percolates through. It's in the Lean filing cabinet.
Yes, that's right, yes. Yeah. I mean, Brief Encounter, to some extent, obviously, is... still has the idea of escape, escape from routine in this case, not necessarily escape from a place. I mean, a brief encounter like The Passionate Friends, and like this to a large extent as well, is the embodiment of you're looking at the middle classes here, very definitely. And in each of these cases, you're having middle class characters making individual decisions.
Yeah.
Or making individual journeys, not part of a collective, as would have happened in Holiday Camp.
Yeah. To pick up on that, David, how symbolic do you think Venice is in this movie? Because Venice is a place that's often used in movies.
Yeah.
And more often than not, it is used as a symbol rather than...
Yeah.
It's rare that you get a film that sort of focuses on Venice for its own attributes. It's often used as a sort of... A means of depicting the inner turmoil of the character or whatever it may be.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Venice has a long history, and I think what you would associate it with now is culture. It's not an obvious place that you would choose to go on holiday if you want, sun, sand and sea. You only go to Venice really in order to look at the history of the place and to look at the Renaissance and your place in it. Which I think is quite interesting. So that you're aligning yourself with a culture and making a statement in that way. And that is more important than the idea of escape or relaxation. We don't really see much of Katharine Hepburn doing the culture, but she is seen in exotic places. Yeah.
What's interesting when you do see her doing that is she carries a Bolex around all the way through the movie. Rather than, you'd expect a character like that, and there are other characters in the film who, you'd expect tourists to be carrying around a box brownie, a little camera or something. But here she is with a movie camera, which is interesting. And of course, we occasionally sort of see through the lens of what she's filming. And what we get is beautifully composed David Lean shots, as though this sort of upper middle class tourist is David Lean. It's weird, but it works for the film, I think.
Is it more of a
we get these great views of Venice through her eyes and through that camera lens.
Mm. Is that not just a more of a statement of sort of like, you can't shoot a bad shot of Venice?
This is
a beautiful place. Yeah. Literally, you could be the worst photographer in the world and every photo you take is a masterpiece. But yeah, I really enjoyed the film. It wasn't typically the type of film I usually enjoy. But I found it quite interesting in the terms of Lean's career.
Yes.
I mean, with Katharine Hepburn, she'd been playing this kind of character, I guess, from like African Queen, and she'd already developed that. People, like Daryl said, people knew what they were expecting from her movie. But for David Lean, I think he'd done the Dickens stuff. He'd done like Blythe Spirit, Brief Encounter, all kinds of stuff. But it was pre a David Lean picture kind of thing,
yeah,
where it was like sweeping vistas
yet.
And things
I
like that.
I think his 50s have got some interesting little nuggets like this in them, and like the film that David mentioned, because I think people know him for his big Dickens stuff in the 40s, and of course we know him for the epics that he did later on, sort of post-Lawrence of Arabia. But the 50s Lean is an area that I think probably needs a little more sort of research and a little more digging into, because this period of his career is often neglected, I think.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so let's move on to, we jump a few years now for your next choice. We jump from 1955 to 1989, so there's just nothing in between those years worth mentioning until 89.
As I say, it was Carry On Abroad and Confessions from a Holiday Camp.
There you go. So we move to 1993, so not 1989, even longer. Bargee on the Beach by Gurinder Chadha, scripted by Mira Sohail.
Yes, I mean, I think this is largely interesting for a mainstream audience in that it includes characters from a different culture and put them in a British setting.
Yeah, was that unusual? Because I watched this again this week, and from a modern audience's, it felt like that's what you do. That's a paint by numbers thing. You take the fish out of that water and put them in a new situation, and it felt like that's what you do. Had this kind of thing been done? Is there films that precede this that set that?
I'm trying to think. Not from inside the culture.
I recall this film coming out, and it was sort of sold and did seem like a shift. It was like, oh, this is new. This is, you know, having these Indian characters involved in what otherwise is a conventional setup that we've seen in sitcoms and comedy dramas and things before. Yeah, I think, you know, it was a bit of a cultural shift.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you're looking as well, the viewpoint is from inside their culture.
Yeah.
We're not looking as a white English person at a culture that we don't quite understand, but we're intrigued by.
Yeah, with a cast and indeed a crew, you know, we've got director and writer who are from that same background.
Yeah.
And these are people that might not have had chances in the British film industry, even 5 or 10 years earlier.
Yeah, but you do have individual stories there.
Yeah,
and the way that they play out while they're all on the beach is interesting. And, of course, you've got the cross-generational conflicts as well. You know, the emerging young people who are keen to have their own individual life, divorced, really, from the culture that they come from.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting to me about that, I'm not a fan of the film, and I don't really like Gurinder Chadha's sort of approach to cinema. I find it... It's more sort of lowbrow than I think she thinks it is, and
I kind of agree.
It's a bit sort of on the nose for me as well. What's interesting about what you're saying there, David, is that those sort of ideas about family conflict and so on, and the sort of hierarchy within the sort of Indian family system. There's lots of talk about the aunties, for instance, all the way through the film. I think that's new to cinema, but I don't think it was necessarily new to the viewers. I think people would be aware of that type of thing simply from sort of talking to your next door neighbours or talking to members of the Indian community, you know, within your town or city. And I always get the sense with Gurinder Chadha that she thinks she's bringing something new that we don't know. And it's almost like she's trying to sort of sell it to a white audience and to say, look, you know, you people don't understand this. This is what my culture's like. And I often sort of shrug and go, well, I do understand it. You know, you're not really telling me anything that I don't know.
It's a populist film, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It wouldn't have been difficult for any white person to watch that film not recognise tropes that it'd seen before.
I felt it was, for me, I mean, I wasn't overly fond of it, and I'm a big fan of a good pun. Barge on the Beach, just the title made in heaven for me. But yeah, I wasn't fond of the movie. And I felt it felt like it's described as a comedy drama. And I felt like it fell in between the two. It wasn't funny enough to be a comedy. It wasn't dramatic enough to be a drama. And it kind of like, I don't really know whether I cared that much.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I'm not a huge fan of the film, I have to say. But I think it's quite interesting. You could argue that it's capturing the director between two worlds.
Mm.
Obviously coming from the culture and trying to engage with the mainstream culture in the country.
Yeah.
And to a large extent, I guess it works.
Yeah.
I mean, Bend It Like Beckham as well works because, well, you're taking on the national sport. You're going to engage with millions of people who like football.
Mm.
Yeah. And the two films we've mentioned already needed to be holiday movies. This one sort of has the holiday a little bit tacked on. Does it need to be set in Blackpool? Do we need the coach trip?
No.
Well, I think
couldn't you tell this story in their hometown?
I think you probably could, but I think the comfort of being in their hometown is taking the characters into a relatively unfamiliar situation. It's not that unfamiliar, but they are out of their town. They are meeting people that they don't know in there. I think that just the symbolism of that, and I think the symbolism of Blackpool as a holiday destination, and I don't think much has changed in the last 30 years of it being a white holiday destination, ultimately, where people go on their holidays.
Do you know the film Hindle Wakes?
Yeah.
From 19... Mm-hmm. Well, I think there was a silent version, but I've seen the 1931 version.
Yeah. It's a big Manchester film.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting that you've got a similar... I mean, that's set in Blackpool. It starts in Blackpool, is it not? With an industrial holiday where... a young mill worker, this young mill working woman, has a weekend fling with the son of the mill owner, and the scandal that ensues from that, whereby the young couple are obliged to marry. But what a strong final statement from the young woman, the mill worker, who says, "I don't want this. Mm-hmm. I want my own individual life, and I want the power over my own life. And, well, I mean, I was going to include Hindle Wakes as one of the films because, well, it's not necessarily a holiday film, but the holiday kickstarts it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see how, well, in many ways, Hindle Wakes is a challenging film. It's challenging people's preconceptions about how society works across the classes. But it's also a strong feminist statement, mm-hmm. and an unexpected one.
Yeah. That was 1952, and you're getting similar themes and tones in Barge on the Beach in 1993. Mm. That's a good, you know, yeah. 30
years. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, Hindle Wakes can be remade. And it could still be made to look like a challenge.
Yeah, yeah.
There's nothing really challenging about Bargee on the Beach.
No, no.
It's got a very odd sort of subplot, Bargee on the Beach, involving the character played by Peter Sellier, Ambrose Waddington, who's this sort of grand old sort of man of the stage and man of the theatre. Mm,
well, the name too.
He hooks up with the character Asher, played by Lalita Ahmed, who is one of the fabled aunties in the film, whose word is law, sort of thing, and it's revealed that he has actually got a connection. His character has actually got a connection with Bollywood through a previous relationship, and
right.
That he's appeared in Bollywood movies. And there's almost this sort of love story or semi-holiday romance thing, almost a sort of condensed version of that, because the ladies are only there for the day sort of thing, aren't they? And there's this very odd fantasy sequence where Asher imagines Ambrose as a Bollywood movie star who rather unfortunately is caked in brown face makeup. Seems looking at it from our perspective in 2021, it seems a bizarre scene, especially as it comes from Indian filmmakers, rather, you know, Indian British filmmakers, rather than a white filmmaker. I found a quote from a book called Bollywood Sociology Goes to the Movies by Rajinder Kumar Dudra, which took a slightly different view to the way I'm looking at it, saying that Asher is woken abruptly to the realisation that Ambrose is a white man with an orientalist sexual fantasy to rescue Asian women who he considers to be oppressed by their own cultures, and that the insertion of Bollywood aesthetics in this segment draw us into the imagination of Asher to enter her dream world, where she is able to fantasise another possibility, but this possibility is placed within a context of social, racial, and sexual power that suggests that neither Asher or Ambrose are suited for each other. So Dudra, in that sense, seems to sort of take Asher's side in this fantasy and project onto this the idea that it's almost like this white male oppressor who's sort of coming on to her in this sort of afternoon in Blackpool, and that she manages to sort of fend him off. But the way that's depicted in the fantasy is pretty outrageous to sort of modern eyes, and may well have been to audiences in 1993, I guess, you know.
This is a film which is more interesting to talk about than to see, isn't it? Thing. I mean, it has it dated? Would you think now?
I've just suggested, I think it may have been dated on the day it came
yes,
out.
Yes, yes. I mean, maybe more dated than Holiday Camp even.
Yeah. I mean, yes, it is. But I think British TV and British films still play strongly on those Indian stereotypes and those Indian cultural uniqueness in things like Citizen Kane.
Like Goodness Gracious Me and so on. In sort of trying to invert and parody the British TV sitcom characters go on holiday sort of idea, you end up making a movie in which sitcom type characters go on holiday.
I mean, this,
and it doesn't really step much beyond that.
I mean, this is the same period, isn't it, more or less, as you've got things like Buddha's Suburbia.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is... well, it's coming from inside the Indian culture.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's taking on something quite different.
Yeah, yeah.
And has
as did a few years before that, My Beautiful Laundress.
I was just thinking of that. Yes,
it's very much the same. So we've already had these. Maybe it's something that works much better in a serious drama than it does in a comedy.
They are more kind of niche pieces, aren't they? I suppose Buddha's Suburbia and My Beautiful Laundress. Yeah, yeah. They're aimed at a demographic that knows, and it's the left-leaning youth culture. Certainly things like My Beautiful Laundrette was, you know, immediately adopted by that kind of, you know, that kind of broad demographic.
Yes.
And also a bit, at the time, it was a challenge to Thatcherism.
Yes.
I mean, that raises the question as to whether she thought that she had a specific audience when she was making this, and was it an Indian audience primarily, or... I assume she had a wider ambition than that.
I think it was the exact opposite. I think with this film, it was much more about like, well, let's try and pack in those middle class white audiences that are attending art house cinemas up and down the country, and give them something like this. They'll sit and watch a French film, no problem, and showing their different culture. Why not do the same thing with an Indian culture?
I think she thinks she's sort of educating a white audience in the ways, the mysterious ways of the Indian family. And I think a lot of audiences of any culture will sort of go along to a film like Barge on the Beach and just shrug and say, well, you're telling me nothing I don't already know.
Maybe not so much as those middle-class white audiences that attended to art house cinemas in the early 90s, though. I think they probably were experienced Indian characters for the first time through movies
Maybe there's an element of the audience that were. I don't know that it was a dominant percentage.
I think one of the other things that stood out for me is there's quite a lot of plot lines in this movie in a similar way to Holiday Camp. And it has that sort of like you juggling multiple storylines, and which feels better if it was a novel. And I don't think they quite manage to get the balance right in the storylines, and certainly not in the acting. I think there's some really bad performances in this movie. There's some really dodgy performances, and then there's some really good performances.
Yeah, well, it's got my favourite bad actor on British TV, Jimmy Harkishin, who's in Coronation Street at the moment. I absolutely love him. He's almost like the Indian Frankie Howard, you know. And he plays the villain in Barge on the Beach. I love him, but he's not the world's best actor by any means. And he has to sort of handle dramatic stuff here. And in the film's big climax, and he doesn't quite cut it, I don't think.
Yeah. Let's move on to our next ones, where these next two films are much more about holiday destinations as catalysts for change, I guess, rather than a holiday and a break and a relaxing. These characters are not doing that much relaxing on these holidays. So first up, we've got Marvin Kaller from 2002.
Yes, that's right. So Lynn Ramsey's second film, based on a novel where a young woman in the film, played by Samantha Morton, her boyfriend, who has written this best-selling book, has died. She has this money bequeathed to her, and she decides to up sticks from Scotland and holiday in Ibiza. On a quest, it sounds corny, to find herself. And obviously she's at the age where she fits into the culture that that we normally associate with Ibiza. But the depictions of that culture are kind of are quite objective. Lynn Ramsey herself has a kind of semi-immersive interest in this destination, but also she stands back. And it becomes rather embarrassing that you have one scene, for instance, set at night, where Samantha Morton is sat out on the balcony, and all round her, this is mayhem going on, where every household is throwing toilet rolls and bottles or whatever and shouting at the top of their voice. And then another time, there is this bit like Holiday Camp, where you have this engineered activity, which is by no means as innocent as the activities in Holiday Camp, where a young man and a young woman are immersed in a pool and they essentially strip each other. And at the end, they emerge with this mini audience around them. And the whole scene is incredibly embarrassing, and even the onlookers themselves look and feel embarrassed at this. It's not something that they're celebrating. It's not a kind of climax in any way. It's an embarrassment. And the film increasingly has that kind of detached attitude towards this holiday center and also the culture it represents.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those ones. I think the interesting thing is not just that her recently deceased boyfriend dies and she gets his money. She steals his novel.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's a really key point. He writes this book, and she writes her name on it. He says, "I've left this book for you." And she put for Marvin Keller. So she takes that as meaning, I can just delete your name off it and put my name on it, and she publishes it.
And of course, it kind of backfires, doesn't it? Because she's expected to write a follow up, and she's interviewed, and it's clear that she had no involvement in this book whatsoever.
But it's also like she's looking to find who she is.
Yeah.
And she starts off by stealing her boyfriend's book and making her as if she's somebody.
And the film ends really with her still looking.
Yeah, still looking.
But looking and more individually, I think, away from the crutches of the culture that she came from or the culture that she thinks she belongs to.
Well, she knows that's not her. And then by the end of the movie,
Have either of you guys read the source novel?
Yeah. Yes, I did.
And the sequel.
Yeah. How close is the movie to the book?
I'm not sure, actually.
I feel like spiritually they're aligned.
Right. I'm asking because I don't particularly like the movie. I'm not a Lynn Ramsey fan, although I'm in a situation where I sort of see her films and I recognise that there's talent there and I recognise that there's a vision there and I've seen all of her movies, but I've got a complete blind spot with her. I just don't take to her sort of style at all. And I find this film a little deficient in that respect. It's me rather than the film, I think. But I just wondered if any deficiencies that I find, do they arise from the source material or do they?
I think both the film they are an enigma, deliberately an enigma.
Yeah, which is, you know, something
maybe in different ways.
Something that I can take to with certain filmmakers, and I just don't get it with Lynn. I just don't sort of pick up on. The clues that she's dropping in that sense, David. Yeah, the scenes you mentioned there about we've got the lads sort of goofing around and throwing water and throwing things at each other across the balconies, and then the stripping scene in the pool. This I think shows the difference between my reaction to the film and yours, because you've obviously found some meaning in that and some sense of a sort of level where Lynn is trying to sort of make a point with those scenes. And I just watched those and thought, these scenes would have been rejected from Carry On Abroad.
Okay.
You know, I think that's the different approach that we're coming at here.
But the whole movie's about her trying to find who she is in a weird sense. You know, she's trying to find herself. Mm. But she literally is in this movie. And I think seeing these people who are behaving how they are supposed to behave, or as the Daily Mail would have you believe these characters behave. And I think the sense of awkwardness and the sense of embarrassment and the sense of feeling disconnected from what's going on is part of that. Yeah. It's part of being that age.
Plus, I guess, the fact that there's this sort of there's this thing she's trying to hide as well. The fact that she's sort of purloined this novel and taken ownership of it.
Yeah, she's a fraud.
Yeah. Which it doesn't, again, to me, says if she's trying to find herself, there isn't all that much to find, really. Or is that the point?
I mean, she has no embarrassment about the fact that she's hiding this, this lie. There's no kind of game plan, is there?
She's not to be.
Yeah, I mean, she's going away from somewhere rather than going to somewhere.
Well, yeah, I don't think she feels like she's stolen the novel.
No,
I think she thinks, he says, it's,
I think,
for
it's
me.
It's an opportunity, and she exploits it.
Well, not
in a cynical way.
Yeah, I don't think it was exploitation. He's like, well, he left it me that book. He left me that book. And he said it was for me.
As though it's a misunderstanding.
Yeah, so I put my... She's
entitled.
Yeah, she's entitled to that because it was given to her. It wasn't like it was, he published it, made loads of money and then gave her the money. It was like, the book is yours to do with whatever you want.
Having said that, Adam, what do you then make of the scenes where the publishers actually telephone her and then actually even come out to the holiday destination to interview her?
Well, that for me is more about exploitation, isn't it? It's like they think they've got the next Irving Welsh or whatever, the next exciting young talent, and they haven't.
Are these supposed to be almost, or not comedic scenes, but are we supposed to be sort of laughing at them and at their mistake while being on the side of the...
Well, I felt like a similar kind of embarrassment. She's not covering up anything either. Mm. She's just expressing her feelings at that moment, and they're completely shallow.
Yeah.
And obviously they're not what these would-be publishers are after whatsoever.
Yeah. There's a character, we've not mentioned so far is the she's got a friend who travels with her, Scottish sidekick.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do we make of her? Is she real? Is she another sort of aspect? Is she there to sort of represent another aspect of Samantha Morton's character, or what's the point of her?
To some extent, I feel that she is the other side of what Samantha Morton's character might have found on holiday. I mean, we recognise that there was a friendship because they worked together. You know, they're close friends. It would be obviously entirely logical for Samantha Morton, for Morven Callor, to take her friend away on holiday. And her friend is completely at ease, really, in this setting. It's what she expects and what she wants. She's not there for any surprises. She's there for, well, a bit of hedonism, really.
Yeah.
And, Morven Callor is unable or unwilling or uninterested in being part of this culture.
So that
which still leaves her as a kind of blank slate. Where does she go from here?
That character needs to be there as a contrast, then. As a means of saying...
Yes, but it's not an artificial one, because there's a relationship already established there.
Of course,
I'm conflicting on whether I think Samantha Morton's good in this movie or not. I think she's specific and unique in this movie. Whether I like the performance or not, it's another matter.
Samantha has this trick of not seeming to act.
Yeah.
That's probably
and she does in this.
I would say. I think you may be supposed to come away from the film feeling like that.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely supposed to have a frustration with her. And the character, definitely, you know.
And that stems from the fact that she isn't necessarily frustrated with herself, or certainly on the level that she's stolen the novel.
Yeah.
We're sort of screaming at the fact that she's there under false pretenses, and she doesn't seem to give a damn. So, which is interesting within that character, I can see.
Yes, I mean, as a central character, we're not seeing the action through her eyes. We always have an objective view of her because she's someone consistently unknowable.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting movie. I think it's one of those ones where, as we've seen, you either connect with or you don't connect with. Mm. I have a nice personal connection with a film in that one of my very early short films that was funded was played before this film in the cinema. So I have a connection to that and a nice warm fuzzy feeling whenever I see the name Morven Callor. But yeah, let's move on to your final one. So we've had Scottish working class 18 to 35 holidays, hedonism, sex. We don't get as much of that in this next one. We get the sex, but we don't get much of the other stuff in Unrelated by Jonah Hogg.
Yes. I mean, this is a film I remember, and I with Sally, we both watched a pre-screening of this in this very cinema, or in cinema in the RDS as it is now. So I have specific memories of seeing this early in the morning, one Friday morning. Joanna Hogg's first film. She'd worked as a director on EastEnders for a number of years, but she'd worked with Derek Jarman as well, which seems odd that she should then sidetrack into EastEnders. But she said about her first film that she deliberately went against all the advice that she'd been given as a director of EastEnders. And clearly, you wouldn't associate Unrelated in any way, I think, with anything from EastEnders. It stars a middle-aged woman, again, like Katharine Hepburn, I guess, who has a long-term relationship with a man, which she's dissatisfied with. It's not giving her the fulfillment she wants. And she is intending to break up this relationship. She is invited on holiday with an old school friend to spend some time in Umbria, close to the town of Siena. In fact, the town of Siena does feature at certain points in this film. Obviously, she comes into this scenario as something of an outsider. Her school friend has a family. She has teenage children. And what's interesting about the film is that Well, on one in one level, the central character is able to evaluate her relationship from a distance. And I think holiday films are quite interesting in this respect, that you can get a different perspective on things that might be troubling you at home, and you don't have a kind of distance while you're in the situation, but you can have an objective view when you're outside it. So to a large extent, she's in a position where she can evaluate objectively the worth of her relationship and whether it's worth going on. But she is sidetracked because she gets more and more involved in the culture of the teenage children. And this sets up inevitably conflicts, but within that culture, but also between her and her friend. So you have this, you have several layers there of conflict. And I found that, well, unexpected in a film that is essentially about holiday. You do get some, well, I guess you could call them exotic shots of Umbria, the countryside, and the town of Siena, which had, there's some nice sequence there. But the themes are quite unexpected. And I think the film lets itself down at the end because I think it resolves itself in rather too neatly. But for the majority of the film, when I first saw it, I was unaware of where the film was going to go.
Yeah, one of the core things about the film is as you say, David, she involves herself in the lives and likes of the younger characters and sort of associates with them as a group. There's then this element where she begins to sort of fantasize or develop this idea that she's going to have a relationship with one of the young men. Mm, mm. And we've got a younger Tom Hiddleston in.
Yes, indeed. I think it might have been his first film.
And that seems to dominate the second half of the movie. And I think it sort of unbalances the film a little bit.
Well, I think it takes it somewhere else, where it was unexpected. You're kind of watching through closed fingers at some of these sequences.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're deliberately... She doesn't belong in this, in that world. She doesn't belong in that age group.
Yeah, so there is this sense of embarrassment. The audience is embarrassed for the character.
Yeah.
And we're almost waiting for some kind of catastrophe or for the whole thing to sort of blow up and then to see what her response to that will be and how she's going to react.
Yeah, for someone on holiday, she's never really at ease.
No. Well, she's almost not on holiday in that sense. You know, she's in a holiday location, but she's got so much anxiety about all kinds of different things and develops new anxieties while she's there. And the pressure just seems to build and build and build.
And you also have a hierarchy here.
Yes.
Clearly, she's not in her career. She's not successful in the way that her friend is.
Mm.
She doesn't have that kind of status.
Yeah. She also seems to be a little bit of an interloper within the group as well.
Yeah.
They've all got their own little relationships and friendships and so on. And she's invited there, but she's almost there on her own. She's the outsider. She's not part of any of the cliques within the unit.
There's one interesting scene where she is and Tom Hiddleston are sat on the steps in Siena, just having a break, and they have a conversation about the worth of relationships. And he, as a hot-blooded teenager, is really all about physical attraction.
Mm.
And she is arguing the case for something deeper and more meaningful. And they kind of have a meeting point, very briefly a meeting point, where they both understand each other.
Because you're making him sound like a shallow character there, and I'm sure you don't intend to, because he isn't. He's got a little more about him.
Oh, he certainly has. I mean, on the surface, we have this hedonist, which you would expect. Someone who is kind of resentful of still about going on holiday with his parents at the age that he is. But very very quickly, he and the others of his age established their own kind of identity within this, and they have their own ambitions about what they want out this holiday. Mm. And it certainly doesn't include the parents.
I must admit, I'm like Daryl on Lynn Ramsey. I have a blind spot when it comes to Joanna Hogg. I kind of give this film a pass when I first saw it, because it was the first one, and also because it felt like we hadn't had a movie like this for a while. We'd had decades of working class stories. We had decades of sort of like different ethnic stories or different cultures being depicted in movies. And then suddenly we got this movie, which was middle class white problems on holiday.
Well, I mean, that's
and it's,
her...
it was kind of like, okay, it's been a good while since we've had a movie like this. And then it started to repeat itself in her work.
Oh, I think that's yeah.
That's definitely something that she goes back
and
to.
And I mean, things like Exhibition that came out that were laughed at. Very much a kind of an artist film about art.
Yeah, and
it can be insular, archipelago.
Archipelago, again, and when I think that's this was followed this one up, and it was just more of the same for me. And it was just like, I think we've mentioned this before, and Daryl quoted The Smiths on it and said, it said nothing to me about my life. And it literally, as I was watching, this literally is completely alien to me. I am not as old as that character, or wasn't when I first saw it, and I'm not as young as the other characters. I mean, I'm caught between those 2 years, so I don't want the hedonism of the youth, but I don't equally want the anxiety of middle age either, middle class. It just didn't land for me at all.
Right, okay.
I appreciated the way it was shot, and I thought it was well done, and the way it was composed, and I liked the pace. I think the pace about her movies is interesting. She doesn't feel like she needs to rush to get anywhere, which I like generally in films. But with this, I'm just, I'm not.
Okay, yeah, I can accept that.
Yeah.
I mean, it invited me in.
Mm.
I mean, you know, like any film, what do you want? You want a world that you actually are in, almost as an unpaid extra. And I did feel invested in this world that was being created.
Yeah, I can agree with that to an extent, David. I don't know why I like films that, and we've had quite a few of them over the years. They're often set in Italy. There've been several films where we've simply had situations of families or groups of friends or so on sat around these big rustic tables with piles of pasta and fruit and great Italian food, and they just have conversation around the table. And somehow, for me, it's riveting cinema. And this is almost like the British version of that. And those were the scenes, and I wish there'd been more of them in
right.
this. That I really sort of felt at home with, and sort of thought I'd quite like to be sat around that table. I'd like to be talking to
what people. I think is interesting, maybe, and I think you could argue the case here with Joanna Hogg, as I think you would with Peter Greenaway, is that these are European filmmakers.
Yes.
They're not British filmmakers. They're European, and it would be interesting to see. Or if I were of a different culture, how if I were French or Italian or Spanish or whatever, how I would related to unrelated.
Yeah,
okay. I think I would have seen a different kind
again,
of film.
I think you can contrast that with Lynn Ramsey's films, which is also set in Europe, but which isn't a European feeling film, is it?
So. She's becoming, well, her films recently have been set in America,
yes,
in the US. Yeah. So there's a different kind of...
I think with Joanna Hogg, they both came out at the same time, but I Am Love by Luca Guadagnino.
Yeah,
that kind of felt like they were sharing similar types of...
That frustrated me. I thought that was... I thought that was art house by numbers.
Oh, yeah, no, me too. But that's what I kind of feel about
Unrelated
and Archipelago. It felt like it was like, well, Eric Roma does this style thing. We're going to go with Eric Roma. We're going to go, it felt like...
With I Am Love, I think, the whole audience must have known where it was going.
Well, yeah, but they...
But I didn't necessarily feel that with Unrelated. But then again, I don't think plot is necessarily the point of Unrelated, which seems to cop out in many ways.
Yeah, no, it's definitely
What are you hooking your audience? The most obvious one is narrative.
Mm. Yeah, no, there's not. It's not in that, definitely. Mm. I mean, the scenes of families getting around dinner tables, I feel like, unless it's like Festen, where there's some actual, like, dramatic reasons to do it, I like scenes where they just sit around the table and it's just like, oh, character work are fine to watch, but I feel like in a movie like this, it just...
Well, I think with a lot of European films, you're getting argument, and that's the driver. That you're getting a dilemma or someone... I mean, what was the film that... the Isabelle Huppert film that came out a couple... Oh, Frankie.
Mm.
That is trading, I think, on films that have gone before. Yeah. I don't think Frankie actually said anything new. Mm. And it didn't even exploit its exotic setting very, very well. So I think it was a bit of a frustration. But that's... to some extent, with films like maybe Morven Callor... Certainly unrelated. That's where you're heading.
Yeah, yeah.
Films where you're getting artificial conflicts, which are kind of played out in the sun, and they may or may not be resolved.
Yeah. What I find really effective about this type of film, though, and about these films with groups of people who are in a sort of confined space or a confined situation, is that they're more like theatre than cinema, really, in terms of their scripts, in that you're getting more, you're getting more than simple conflict. Often in movies, we get one character or one set of characters pitted against another. I think the larger the group, the more viewpoints come into play, and you're often getting three or four sort of ways of looking at things or sides of an argument. It's great that that happens, and if it happens around a table that's piled with gorgeous-looking food as well, I'm fine with that. I think that can work dramatically really well. It's easy to get wrong.
Any final thoughts on the genre as a whole?
Well, I think we've established, and I think, you know, I think we're correct in saying that there is a British genre, that this, you know, we have a British attitude towards the holiday film, which I don't see replicated necessarily. You mentioned Italy, but it's not necessarily associated with, you know, a country making films about that their countrymen going abroad. I'm not sure that they have, you know, they have common threads. I mean, one film that, again, that I was nearly considering, but it's an outlier in this context, is Mr. Hulot's Holiday.
Yeah.
And you can understand why that's an international success, because there's very little language in it.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's all physical comedy. But that, I think, is a very interesting film. And it is clearly a French film.
Yeah.
I don't think that another country would have made that film with that iconic central character and all the mayhem that he creates or that he's embroiled in.
I think it's quite funny because I think the French mentality of the holiday is just it is just a holiday generally within France in that case. Whereas Britain, it's more about taking the British culture and mentality and putting it in an alien culture.
Well, we haven't mentioned it, but obviously weather is a factor. We can never guarantee in this country that if we holiday in this country, we're going to get 2 weeks of sun.
No.
You go to Portugal or Spain or France or Italy, and it's virtually guaranteed. So you don't have that kind of question mark.
No, you don't. Yeah, staycations are much more tolerable when you have consistent weather patterns like that.
Yeah.
I've just got a couple of extra films to mention very briefly as recommendations if people haven't seen them. One from 2009, made by a lot of Shane Meadows regulars. It's The Scouting Book for Boys, with Tom Turgoose as the lead character, Tom Harper as a director who worked on the This Is England TV shows, and Jack Thorne, who wrote for This Is England, as the script writer. And again, it's a summer holiday camp caravan, typical caravan site, very recognisable to most British viewers, I'm sure. A story of two teenagers who get together, 14-year-old boy and a young girl, who sort of become friends and have adventures around the holiday camp. And then it all lurches into this sort of rather murky sort of thriller territory towards the end. I mention the film because I think it really evokes that very, very British world of the caravan site extremely well. And, you know, you can put your own sort of metaphors or whatever viewpoint you like on that as a backdrop for the action that's going on in the film. The other film I wanted to mention is from 1970. It's called And Soon the Darkness. It was written by Brian Clemens, the great British thriller writer, who indeed went on to make a TV series called Thriller in the 70s. And this was almost like a pilot film for that TV show, made in 1970 with Michel Dautrice and Pamela Franklin. And they're playing two young nurses who go on a cycling holiday in the French countryside. And it's like North by Northwest, or like a lot of those classic films that use bright sunlight and big open spaces as a situation for abject terror. It sets these girls into this world that isn't a dungeon. It's not a castle with shadowy corners and things leaping out from everywhere. You couldn't get more open countryside than this. It's set along a long stretch of road, lovely fields and trees and countryside in the background, and yet these girls are being stalked by a killer, or the threat of a killer. They don't even know whether it's happening or not, because they can't speak the language. Mm. They don't know any French. And of course, the areas that they're cycling through are very rural. Nobody there speaks any English. So there's a communication problem. They pick up the idea that there's a killer in the area and that he's targeting young women. And then one of the girls goes missing. And it's the idea of open space and the idea of language both being used as a means of confusion and potential terror that I think is this film's real strength. It's called And Soon the Darkness, and I think that's a great title because it emphasises the fact that the entire movie is actually set in bright sunlight and yet maintains this air of total terror.
In the 1970s, there was a film waiting to be made with that title.
Yeah.
And when you were talking as well there, two other films that came to mind were Sightseers, set on the campsite, and the Mike Leigh TV film, Nuts in May, which in a very British way is class against class.
Yeah. And I think Sightseers really emerges out of Nuts in May. I think it's very influenced by it.
Right,
so
yeah.
They're a nice little pair, I think.
Yes.
They're two films that are about class on the campsite, really, aren't they?
Yeah.
Two comedy films I think probably deserve a mention here. I mean, we've talked quite a lot about the dramatic purposes of this kind of movie, but like comedy, obviously With Nail and I, We've Gone on Holiday by Mistake is a classic example.
Indeed it is.
But also ties in with that sort of like the catalyst for change, the holiday being that catalyst for change and giving you a time in With Nail and I. It's through the trauma of the holiday that the catalyst
and the weather reflects that completely.
Well, you've got characters who not only have they gone on holiday by mistake, but they almost don't want to be there. Yeah. You know, they don't want to be on holiday. They'd rather be doing other things.
The other one I want to mention, it's not quite a holiday movie, but it's like a film called Get Duked. Which is about four kids who go on a orienteering holiday for the Duke of Edinburgh Award and come up against very posh hunters who are not hunting game. with Eddie Izzard's in that one. But that was a real surprise for me. I saw that last year. I think it's available now, but one to check out. Okay, thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Daryl. And I want to thank the BFI and Quad for supporting these podcasts, and we will see you in 2 weeks' time. Take care.